Good afternoon, everybody. We're back to driving you into serious multitasking now, in that both the vision and the language parts of this course have gotten significantly more intense, and especially for those of you, including me, who have to move from this lecture about language to a tutorial about the frogs, what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain in an hour. The sort of grinding of gears as we switch is going to be a little extreme. However, I have to ask you to do your best to think language for the next hour, or 50 minutes, rather. Well, I realize this says 2010 and also 2012. Well, it's 2012. Before we start seriously confronting a couple of models of past tense behavior, of the cognitive processes involved, we have to get just a little more of the facts of the matter at a descriptive level, at the linguistic level, if you will, under control. And so that's what we're going to do today, is press a little harder and a little deeper into the question of just what's going on with this question of past tense inflection. And we're going to start with the sort of high level and drill down as we go. This kind of statement that you see on the screen, that language is an instrument by which we communicate, and that there are ideas in our heads and words in the air, and they map more or less one-to-one, and we use them to move ideas from our heads into other people's heads, or vice versa. It's common sense, it's widely held, and it's wrong. Things are, if anything, so much more complicated than that, that that's not just wrong because it's too high level, it's wrong because it's profoundly misleading. And language does have a connection, or does play a part of establishing connections between mental things and acoustic things, but there's nothing remotely resembling a single step, and the connection is anything but unequivocal. At the level of our understanding, at the broadest level of our understanding of the human linguistic process, it's something like this. That if we think that at the one end of the story there are beliefs and desires, and at the other end of the story there are articulators and receptors. For spoken language, it's the mouth and the ears. Then the process of getting from one to the other, or vice versa, involves at least this much of a decomposition, with at least some ordering between what has to happen first and what has to happen second, and so on. And so on the traditional account, and we'll look at details of this and at alternatives to this over the next few lectures, you recognize some bits of this. We have words stored in a lexicon, and I wish this hover text would go away. I'll use this instead because it won't provoke the hover texts. So we have stored entries for words, including the irregular verbs. We talked about this last time, 8 days ago, whatever. Yeah, 9 days ago. We have rules for forming complex words out of simple words, including the regular past tenses. We have syntax or grammar for rules for forming phrases and sentences out of words. All of that interacts with the meanings that we are trying to express if we're going this way, or that we're trying to make sense of if we're coming this way. And all of which interact with what linguists call phonology, the ways in which the words and their subparts and their overall structure get turned into sound that you hear. And some of that is mediated at the lexical level, but some of it is even mediated at the syntactic level, because otherwise there'd be no difference between the way that I say, Robin went for a pint after lunch, and did Robin go for a pint after lunch? So Robin went for a pint after lunch, pitch goes down at the end. Did Robin go for a pint after lunch? Pitch goes up at the end, because the first is a statement and the second's a question, and so on, right? So we have some complicated decomposition of the kinds of things we know, the kinds of things that are different from one language to another, right? All of this is at least potentially different between a native speaker of English and a native speaker of Japanese, right? Where it's a question for the philosophers whether a native speaker of English and a native speaker of Japanese have the same beliefs and desires, or whether the linguistic actually penetrates all the way to the level of thought. And that's a long-standing open question, which we won't have anything to say about. But everything else here certainly is at least potentially different between any two, between speakers of any two different languages. So all of this is part of what you know about your language. And we talked about this words versus rules thing, dividing up the mental, our knowledge, just in the space of verbs, into the difference between the lexicon and productive rules. And we hypothesized about irregulars and regulars, that irregulars are stored as single words, whereas regular past tenses are formed by rule. But we've been a little sloppy about the word word here, and further to the distinctions that Pinker makes in the book, we need to now be careful to distinguish between two things. One is the sort of thing we see on the page, or we think we hear in the acoustic stream, the thing that makes up phrases which then turn make up sentences, the things that in writing we separate with spaces approximately, versus the unit that's stored in the mental lexicon, whatever that may be. And the question of the two, the relation between the two, is precisely what we're talking about in talking about regular versus irregular verbs. Something that's been memorized. Pinker calls it a listeme, which is an utterly useless word. I'm just putting it up here because you may wonder how this connects up to what's in the book. This is how. I will never use this word again. This doesn't work for me. I'm sorry. But it's important to note that this second sense, the things that you memorize, the things that are indivisible, if you will, not only covers things which appear only as parts of this kind of word, right? Prefixes, suffixes, like ed, in fact, in particular, right? But also, that things in your mental lexicon may be more than one word in the first sense long. Idioms, cliches, and collocations, beat around the bush, to and fro. Famously, the word fro, F-R-O, appears in English only in the phrase to and fro. Right? You can't say fro and to. You can't say I went fro the door, right? Or I went fro the path, right? Or I went fro, right? It's a frozen historical remnant that happens to be spelled with spaces, to and fro. Right. Looks like a phrase, but it isn't, because you can't do any of the things with it that you can do with a phrase like in the dark. You can't take it apart, you can't say it backwards, and so on and so forth. Right? Beat around the bush, kick the bucket. The other thing about these is the meaning of these phrases is not related to the meaning of the words. Right? Kick the bucket, at least in American English, means die, euphemistically. Right? And as far as I know, there's nothing particular to buckets or kicking buckets that connects up with death. But if you say, you know, our favorite pet cat kicked the bucket last week, it does not mean this cat is an aspiring footballer, slightly confused about what it is he, she, or it should kick, but rather that it died. Right? See Monty Python. At the level of the particular concern that we have with the past tense, on this account, walked is a word as morphological object, but not as a word as lexical entry. It's a complex one that's made up of two distinct things you find in the mental lexicon, the stem or base form walk and the suffix ed. That's the analysis that we've already gone through. And the word we use, the word the linguist uses for these things, and why, I guess the only reason that Pinker doesn't want to use the word morpheme is because it's not normally the case that people call things like to and fro or beat about the bush morphemes. But that word is historically at least reserved for things that are smaller than the words that you see on the page or that you hear in your speech. So we've got two kinds of rules that we've at least informally mentioned so far. Right. Morphological rules, the kinds that are used to build up morphological words, the words that appear in sentences and phrases and so on, from the things you find in the dictionary. And syntactic rules that you use to build up phrases and sentences out of words, either complex words or simple words, whatever way you do it. Why are they different? Right. Why are these not, why is this not all just, why don't we just have this set of morphemes and this set of rules and there's no particular point in distinguishing the two? Well, here's one kind of evidence that's usually appealed to, at least in English, for making the argument. You find different arguments in different languages. In a collection of varying collection of nouns, and apologies to the non-native speakers who probably won't, well, you may have even had a lecture about this in your English class, but if you didn't, this may be new to you, but the rest of you native speakers of English will probably recognize at least some of this as a question which has arisen for you at some point or other. What is the plural of passerby? Is it passersby or passerbys? Mother-in-law, right? I have two mothers-in-law. I have two mother-in-laws. I get different answers for these two. I'm with passers-by on the one hand and mother-in-laws on the other hand. But most of you are too young to have a mother-in-law. Most people, of course, don't have two. But if I did, that's how I'd say it. I only have one. That's enough. That wasn't a joke. She's very nice. Attorney General, right? Is that attorneys general or attorney generals? By and large, in corpora these days, you'll find this one. But at least historically, it was more likely to be that one. Out on the golf course, how many holes in one were scored today? How many hole in ones did you have? Those lucky people who've ever had one, much less more than one. Tablespoon. All right, we got tablespoonful. 3 tablespoonfuls of baking soda to make these pancakes. 3 tablespoons full. I'm not even sure which one I say of those, frankly. Gin and tonic, on the other hand, definitely this one. Gin and tonics. I want 3 gin and tonics, please, right now. Jack in the box. Well, some people claim they've even heard the last of these. Jacks in the boxes. I don't think so, but hey, I'm not going to argue, right? Jacks in the Box? Almost certainly not. Jack in the Boxes, yes. Any of you even know what a Jack in the Box is? It's an old-fashioned toy. I don't think they're much found anymore. Yeah, exactly. You wind it up and it goes, pops, you know, yeah. You would think so, yes. And the account that a linguist will give you of the existence of both forms relies on a difference between syntax and morphology, right? Between making that level, drawing that boundary. Because, the story goes, it depends on how you chunk things up, on what's in the lexicon. If you have a word in your lexicon, mother-in-law, then you're going to form the plural by adding s to that word to get mother-in-laws. But if you don't have that stored as a word, you just have mother and in and law, and you make a phrase out of them using the using the grammar. So mother, who happens to be my mother, not in reality but in law, could, you know, closer to that understanding of it, then we'll get mothers-in-law. Because I'd certainly say, in reality, very few people have three mothers. Three mothers in reality is very unusual, right? To extend the analysis a little bit, we have to think just a little bit about how this account of pluralization works compared to how our account of plural of past tenses work. Right? It's going to be a similar story. That for, you know, the vast majority of ordinary words, either you add an S to the end, so girl, girls, or it's irregular, man, men, right? But leaving aside the irregulars, for the regulars, for most words, we add S to the end of the word. In English, where we tend to, where occasionally at least, we have words which are compounds that are written as single words. Right? So cowgirl is written without a space, and it's cowgirls. Right? Because girl is the head noun of the compound. And in general, in English, when we form compounds, whether we spell them with spaces or not. So if I talk about laptop display monitor, right? It's a three-word noun compound. Laptop is a noun, display is a noun, monitor is a noun, right? Laptop display monitor, and I want several of them. It's the monitor that I'm talking about. It's a display monitor, it's a laptop display monitor, but it's a monitor, it's not a laptop, it's not a display, it's a monitor. So I say laptop display monitors. English tends to compound to the right. That is, the last word is what it is, and everything before it is a modifier. And that's where adjectives go as well. So I have a red book, or I have a nonfiction book. I have a laptop computer, I have a desktop computer, they're both computers. Right? But once I have a desktop computer monitor, that's a monitor. And so the plural goes on the thing that it is. That's what is being talked about here, is the head. And again, even for phrases which aren't made up all of nouns, it's sort of obvious that it's the head word that gets made plural. Whether it's the first word or the last word, so maybe adjectives and compound nouns, the head is usually the last word in English, but in prepositional modifiers come afterwards, and it's not girl from Ipanema's, it's girls from Ipanema, right? It's displays on the desk, not display on the desks. Because there's only one desk here, there are two displays. Right? So displays on the desk. So there's this sense that the word is getting made plural, and it's the word that's the head of the whole phrase. However, language changes, language develops, and as the language changes and develops, one of the things that happens, especially up until 4,000 years ago, is that we reanalyze what's going on, that between one generation and the next, how people divide the language up changes. And where the words are connected up changes. And sometimes we even know what's happened. And so the names of the weeks in English have echoes of not one, but three, I think, different ancient religions buried in them. Right? So we have Thursday, which is Thor's day, which is Norse mythology, Norse religion, if you will, Thor, god of lightning and war, and so on. Right? We have Saturday, which is Saturn's day, from the Latin. And wait a minute, what have we got? Monday, it's not clear who to blame that on. Monday, Tuesday, I don't remember about Tuesday. Anybody know? Wednesday is the Norse again. That's Woden. Woden. Woden's day, Tor's day. Friday is, I think, Freitag is Freya, is another Norse goddess, right? Saturday, however, is Saturn. And Sunday, well, the sun and the moon, right? You pick your antecedent for that. Those are, I don't know whether those are Anglo-Saxon or, I think those are actually Romance rather than Anglo-Saxon, but I'm not sure. So those things used to all be phrases, right? So-and-so's day, so-and-so's day, so-and-so's day. And they got reanalyzed a long time ago, packaged up into a single word so that aside from a few obscure Christian fundamentalists who object to using pagan names for the days, the fact that there are gods buried inside these names is long gone. Right? Long, long gone. Nobody knows that. Right? Breakfast, breaking your fast, goodbye, God be with you, business, no longer implies busyness, but it did, right? It was just busyness, and it meant busyness, being busy. And it got sort of frozen and transposed into denominating this whole class of activity, which may or may not involve busyness. Christmas, of course, and Candlemas and all the other, Michaelmas and all the rest of them. Spinster, right? Used to literally mean somebody who spun wool. Nothing to do with married or unmarried, young or old, et cetera, et cetera. Morphologically complex, historically, not anymore. We no longer perceive the internal structure of the words. That's gone. And if you start paying attention as you, you know, wander through the rest of the day or the week or the month, you'll notice words like this popping up all the time. Some of them, you know, even sort of dead metaphors. Riverbed, a classic example. You ever wonder why riverbeds are called riverbeds? Well, it's because it's where the god of the river sleeps. Maybe. I don't know. Some of these, of course, are bogus. Who knows? How could you tell whether this was true or not? I mean, it takes a huge amount of historical investigation to figure this out. But histories are buried inside words, sometimes quite complex ones. Some of them, of course, I don't know, presume. So here's an interesting, another class of these. There are people's names, not just gods and goddesses, but ordinary people's names are buried inside words. What's interesting is some of these go in and out of use. How many of you have ever heard and know the meaning of the word Quisling? A handful. Right? Quisling was the premier of Norway, I think. Norway? Anybody know? Yeah, Norway, who made the treaty with the Nazis. And so it was for at least 50 or so years used as a synonym for traitor, roughly. But it's sort of disappearing as knowledge and care about the Second World War sort of disappears. On the other hand, what's the, you know, what's that black stuff on that is on that covers the road out here between here and the other side of the street? One of the words for it is, anybody, begins with a T? Tarmac. Do you know where that comes from? It's the word tar, for tar, and the name macadam, because the first man to actually mix gravel with tar and lay it down for a road surface was named macadam. And indeed, it was originally called tar macadam, and that got shortened to tarmac. And so, you know, for as long as we have tarmac on the roads, this guy is in the language. But what happens, of course, is that these changes occur while there are still lots of people, you know, when this process is running actively, you get tension across the language as older speakers and younger speakers don't have the same story about what's going on. So an example that Pinker uses, it's not a great example, but it's not bad, is that for anyone under about the age of 30, awesome is just a synonym for good. I mean, it's a particular, you know, it's not just a synonym for good. It's a synonym for good, which is appropriate in certain registers in certain contexts, but it basically means good. Whereas anybody over about 70, awesome is a word you would only ever use in a religious context. And it means that it's, you know, engendering awe of a particularly religious nature. The word has changed its meaning in the course of the last 30 or 40 years. Other examples, I mean, a couple of other examples just to make the point. Pronunciation is perhaps the most obvious place where this happens and the most difficult to notice it. Those of you who are native speakers of British English, the next time you're home and talking to your parents on the phone and it comes up in conversation, notice what it is that they pick up at the shop where you buy such things and read at home in the evening. It's like large and has lots of pages, right? Because even for me, but the problem is I'm American by birth, and so the thing is made more complicated, but certainly, you know, for most people of your generation, that's a newspaper, right? But for people in the roughly just, you know, most of you are young, so your parents are in their 30s, 40s, 50s. They're on the cusp. You may need to check with your grandparents. For them, it's a newspaper, not a newspaper. Right? Did you hear the difference? You didn't even hear the difference, did you? I'll say it as slowly and carefully as I can. For you, it's a newspaper. For them, it's a newspaper. Right? That palatal, that what's called palatalization, the y sound there, is disappearing from the language in certain contexts. So your grandfather, or perhaps even your great-grandfather, wore a suit to work if he worked in a certain kind of environment. But since about the 1950s, people wear suits, right? Not suits. On the other hand, only apparently under 15s listen to music. All the rest of us listen to music. But I used to say there are words that haven't moved yet. Music is one of them. And then people stuck their hands up and said, no, I hear people saying music. I haven't, but maybe it's coming. Because that sort of shift is happening in the language. Go figure, right? If I have time, I'll tell you another one, but I think I won't. So the analysis that we then are left with about mother-in-law is, it's a question of how much this word has moved into the lexicon. This phrase that started out certainly as a phrase, and if you look in the, you know, if you look back in 17th or 18th or 19th century manuscripts, books, whatever, you will not find mother-in-laws at all. You will only find mothers-in-law. But now, that's because it was like this, right? It was a noun phrase made up of a noun and a prepositional phrase. So just like computers on the desk, not computer on the desks, right? It was mothers-in-law because it was a phrase. Mother was the head noun. But now, that phrase has become reanalyzed as a word. In which case, it's obvious that its plural is mother-in-laws. I just lost the people. Yeah, sorry. I hate it when people do that. It follows, right, that there has to be some difference between morphology and syntax, right? That there's a choice here about where things are happening. Syntactic rules have to all come after morphological rules so that we get mothers and then we build up the noun phrase. Because otherwise we build up the noun phrase and then we, whoop, too late, you know, where do I put the S? Other aspects of the history of the language are buried here. There are words which are still where it's still pretty robustly the case that we do have governors general, solicitors general, and things like that, because they largely appear in formal contexts where their history as noun adjective phrases from the original French, dating back to the Norman conquest, is preserved. Because those of you who are French speakers who have studied French know, in French, most adjectives appear after the noun. However, the one place where we've lost it is in major generals, because people think they are generals, not majors. Right? In fact, historically, they were majors. And it would have been majors general, just like lieutenants general. But now they've become understood to be generals, and so it's major generals, and nobody says majors general. Because it's been reanalyzed, because it could be an adjective more, you know, historically, contemporarily. So that's sort of the argument for distinguishing between morphology and syntax and placing a large number of word-level processes in this sort of box labeled morphology. English verb inflection, compared to lots of other languages, is incredibly simple. It's not as simple as Chinese. It's probably a tiny bit more complicated even than Japanese, but by and large, compared to wonderfully complicated languages, or even most of the other Indo-European languages, it's pretty simple. We typically only have four forms for the vast majority of our verbs. Open, opens, opening, opened is a good middle-of-the-road verb with four standard forms. Spanish and Italian, 50 forms. Different forms for first, second, and third person. That's I, or we, you, or you, he, she, it, they. Singular and plural, I versus we, you versus you, him versus they. Past, present, and future, well, that was different forms for the verbs with that kind of subject. Past, present, and future, depending on when the action the verb is describing happens. Indicative and subjunctive, whether it's real or whether it's putative, whether it might happen or might have happened versus whether it did happen or will happen, and so on, right? There are more exciting languages. Well, we have at least one Hungarian speaker in the room. Hungarian has at least a couple of thousand forms, if you count in the sort of obvious way. There are Bantu languages which have, you know, hundreds of thousands. The word for this, for what goes on in English, where the same form covers a range of different meanings that other languages split out into different forms, is called syncretism, right? Four forms shared between 13 different roles, roughly speaking, that other parts of the English language discriminate. The normal present tense, I open the door, right? I, the microphone. Open the door, right? The imperative. Infinitive, I tried to open the door. And subjunctive, I wish that she would open the door, or insisted that she open the door. Perhaps she might open the door. We add the S suffix for just one tiny little case. It's so bizarre, right? This huge, vast space that we use the infinitive for, and then we have this form which only gets used for third-person singular present tense. Right? She opens the door. But guess what? That forms something like 30 or 40% of the usage of most verbs in most circumstances. The ing suffix gets about two, three forms. Progressive participle, she is opening the door. Present participle, I tried opening the door. And a verbal noun or gerund, her incessant opening and closing of the door really made me angry. And similarly, adjectivally, a quietly opening door, or easily opening door, or just an opening door. An opening door can be really scary at the end of a horror movie. ED gets used for some quite different things. We got into this a little bit, at least in my tutorial group last week, arguing about some of the words in the Rumpelstiltskin passage that we looked at, whether they were past tense or passive participles. Quite different in meaning. I opened the door. The door was opened by Mary. The door is being opened by Mary. That's not past. It's passive. And we also get the past adjectival use, a recently opened door. So one way of thinking about this is that syncretism is a way of being parsimonious with your inflections, that you reuse the inflections for different purposes. It's often the case that historically you will find that these things have been different and they've collapsed. But that's not always the case. Irregular verbs actually may have, slightly surprisingly you might think, may have more forms. And this is an area where the language is under a lot of stress, as you can tell when I get to one of these examples, I think. Right? But the past of sing is sang. He sang a lullaby. But the perfect is sung. Right? He had sung. Past participial form. The participial form. I ate a sausage. I have eaten a sausage. But in dialect, I ate a sausage, I have ate a sausage. Right? They've fallen together. The verbal adjective even is sometimes different. This is very rare now. A newly wedded couple versus they have wed. The couple have wed, but they were wedded yesterday. Right? A drunken sailor, he's drunk a lot of beer. Right? That one gets confused and it's not clear it's surviving. Right? A drunk sailor is pretty okay these days. And alternate, on the other hand, you will hear people saying, he's drunk a lot, yes, you know, he's drunk a lot tonight, instead of he's drunk a lot tonight. So, yeah, hard to know what that one's, how that one's going. A shrunken head, someone has shrunk the head. Right? That one's rarer and more stable. And of course, there's one English verb, the most used verb of all, which preserves 8 distinctions out of the 13. The verb to be, borrowing forms from 3 different Anglo-Saxon words, be, am, is, are, was, were, been, being. The other side of the coin from syncretism is allomorphy. If in syncretism is about taking one form and using it for several different purposes, in a slightly different way, allomorphy is about having one purpose, one role, but having multiple forms for it. And you'll see that this is not quite the same as the opposite of syncretism, but it's related. Right? If you consider the regular past tense suffix, which we write ed most of the time, we discussed this briefly. It's actually pronounced in at least three different ways. It's pronounced as a t in walked. It's pronounced as a d in jogged. And it's pronounced as an ud. Ud. Patted. Ud. A little bit more about notation. We talked about the star last time. Well, we'll use square brackets to say what's inside these square brackets are not letters, but they're phonemes, which is the name linguists use for the, well, the sort of abstract level of analysis of the inventory of sounds that's used in a language. So English has on the order of 40 phonemes. There are languages with as few as 10 and as many as 60. English is somewhere a little bit above the mean, not much. We have a fairly modest number of vowels compared to some of the European languages. French and Swedish, Norwegian have 10 or 12. English has 5 or 6, depending on how you count. We write them in what's called the International Phonetic Alphabet. Many of the phonemes in that alphabet look like letters in the English alphabet, so the verb some, the word some, the s is spelled with the s letter and the m is spelled with the m letter, but the uh in the middle, which is called a schwa, remember, letters have names. So the letter that we write like this is called an H, right? But it sounds, well, the letter that's called schwa sounds uh. And it's written because when people started doing this phonology stuff, linguistic analysis, back in the 19th, early 20th centuries, we didn't have computers, code type, all the rest of that cool stuff, right? It was all done by typography. And so by and large what they did was they took existing lead slugs and repurposed them. So by taking the E slug and turning it upside down, you get the schwa. So you don't have to go cast new type in order to set phonemes. So when you see things in square brackets from now on, it's meant to be an indication of pronunciation rather than spelling. We have a similar, so the point is that the what we think of and what we have already started calling the past tense morpheme in English, the regular past tense morpheme, is realized phonologically in three different ways, as t, as d, and as nd. And the same thing goes for the plural. And there's actually something similar going on here. That the plural S is manifest either as S or as Z or as Z in the same, in a way that's really quite parallel here. And when we talk about features, if we ever get to features, I think we will, the fact that linguists will say, actually, there's something to be explained here. Why do these two things look sort of similar? And we should be able to explain it once, not twice. And indeed, we can. We don't, in general, want to say that there are three past tense suffixes. We want to say there's one, and then there's some way in which the allomorphy explains the way in which it appears. And one plural suffix. one suffix for each rule, and phonology rules. Third kind of rule now. We have phonological rules, we have morphological rules, we have syntactic rules. So, just about done. Well, that's good, because I only have two more slides left. We have verb stems in the lexicon, or base forms, talk, want, sneeze, the past tense suffix D, and a morphological rule that says to form the past tense, add the suffix to the end. So we get those strings, those phonological words, if you will, complex phonological words made up of two morphemes each. And then the phonological rules take over to fix two out of the three of these. Because this one's just fine as it stands. Sneezed. That is the past tense of sneeze. Right? But these guys need to be fixed, because this is not togged, and this is not wund. I can't even say them. And that's a clue as to why they get changed. The two rules have got names. They're Greek. Anaptixis is the name which says, if you have two adjacent consonants that are too similar to one another, then insert a schwa, this sort of neutral vowel. So instead of wanted, we get wanted. On the other hand, the devoicing rule says, if you have a duh immediately following an unvoiced consonant, then devoice it. That's technical terminology for the relationship between the pairs of sounds s and z and v t d. Can't make those because they're mostly silent. The difference is whether or not your vocal cords are turned on or not. If you could, you can say s, and there's nothing happening here, right? All the noise is coming from the turbulence made by the narrowing of the airway between my tongue and the back of my teeth. But you can feel the vibrations. That's the vocal cords kicking in, adding to the sound. Right? So from talked, we get talked. So there aren't three distinct past tenses. There's one. And the phonological rules, which also come into play to deal with the SZ distinction in the plurals. Right. Yes, just time. It didn't used to be this way. As late as Middle English, 400, 500 years ago, talked and sneezed were the past tenses. Right? By early modern English, 1600, 1700, the schwa had been elided, and we got to where we are today, to talked and sneezed. And at that time, you would find these things to try to reflect, these things written in manuscript, to try to reflect the change, to reflect that the past tense of talked was not talked anymore. But we owe our spelling, for better or for worse, to Samuel Johnson and his standardized English spelling, where he didn't like the apostrophe for reasons unknown to me, and he put the E back in the written language. He couldn't change the spoken language. That was outside his control. But he had a huge amount of influence among the printers in London. The printers in London pretty much determined how written English was written. So he changed the spelling. We don't know, you know, what changed the pronunciation hundreds of years before then. That's it. That reminds me of one other thing I wanted to say, which was I mentioned 4,000 years. Anybody know what happened 4,000 years ago? More or less, roughly speaking. Oh, the world began. Yes, I'm sorry, I forgot. No, that's Bishop Usher. 4,000 years ago is roughly the first attested example we have of writing. First time the language got written down. We really don't know how much the advent of writing and then printing and then broadcast media and then, you know, iPhones and iPads and iPods and who knows what, how much that's going to change the rate at which the language evolves. We just don't know. They haven't been around long enough. Languages move pretty fast for the first 200,000 years of their history, as far as we can tell, as near as we can figure it out by triangulation. There's some suggestion that the change is slowing down. And that might be because we've got printing now. But nobody knows for sure. The first assignment is out. It's two weeks ago yesterday. There is a handout for today, for tomorrow's lab. Please print out one copy and bring it with you, because you'll need it. You'll have to scribble on it. Sorry that this came out late. There was a failure of communication between several of us. You should have been notified sooner. Don't worry about it for today. But from now on, you should check the lecture timetable, look at the tutorial, and prepare in advance for your tutorial. Read the tutorial handout, see what it says. If it asks you to do something, please do it. Read chapter 2 of Words and Rules by the end of the week, please. That's it. See you on Thursday, except for those of you who are coming upstairs right now. Yes.
Running from the median.
Yes.
And I want to know if when referring to suffixes, restricted referring to suffixes or suffixoids and suffixes and prefixoids and
prefixes. As long as you... Let me tell everybody about remaining.
As long as you make clear what you're talking about, that's what matters.
Okay.
There's no rules, right? The purpose of this exercise is to demonstrate to me that you can start thinking about a language.
Okay.
Not that you... figured out exactly what I mean by some of the technical terms that I use in the assignment. So tell me what you mean by that distinction. Don't assume I know.
Yep.
And then use it.
Okay. And would you consider stuff such as anglophobe and anglophile as antonyms?
Well, what's interesting is that sort of expands the assignment a bit. If you want to, go ahead. But
okay.
The point is that what phil and phobe are antonyms of each other.
Yep.
They don't take a stem and invert it.
Yep.
Right? So happy, we can make it unhappy. You know, famous, we can make it infamous. That's not quite the same as saying anglo, we can make it anglophobe.
Yep.
Something different going on there, right? Okay.
So that's only chapter 2 of Pinker's book?
I can't remember if it says on the lecture notes more. Right, well, it 2 goes with today, basically.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, also part of 3, because I went to 3 this morning and I found that not part of it was expected, or at least the beginning.
Yeah, well, the problem is they don't fall perfectly across the lectures. It went up earlier today. I'm sorry I failed to put it up on Friday. I left here and went to the airport. And I screwed up. I'm sorry. It's there now. Yeah. Okay, so most of them are Scandinavian.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I think
how Saturn got in there is just weird.
Sun and moon are Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah,
but
good.
I realized I just sort of started riffing on that and realized I wasn't sure, so I thought I'd better not say anything.
Cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
And it's absolutely like 50 online.
It is.
It's online.
It is now.
Oh, okay. Thank
right.
You.
And both